Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly podcast from the magazine The Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy Indigenous Columbus Day, everyone.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Monday.
So it's not really a happy Monday, people. The world turned upside down over the weekend, or at least Saturday morning, when Hamas, the radical Islamic overseers of the Gaza Strip of land between southern Israel and the eastern Mediterranean Sea, executed a shocking and barbaric series of raids and attacks and kidnappings in Israel, killing an estimated 700 people, including 260 who were attending a music festival, and also taking some 150 hostages. All these numbers are subject to massive revision, I am sure. There have reportedly been at least 9 Americans killed. We don't know about the hostage situation yet, as well as citizens of other countries. It was the worst attack on Israeli soil in the 75-year history of the country, the deadliest day for Jews since World War II, and has been frequently characterized as Israel's 9/11, right down to the catastrophic intelligence failure. Israel has responded by recalling all its military reservists, massing troops on the Gaza border, declaring a complete siege on the territory, and announcing its intention to remove Hamas from power via overwhelming force. The death toll in Gaza, even in these preliminary stages of the Israeli counterattack, is already in the hundreds. As always, in this part of the Middle East, there are endless geopolitical overlaps here. Hamas in Gaza has chiefly been sponsored by Qatar and Iran, both of which have been opposed to the proposed expansion of the Abraham Accords, the peace agreements between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain, to potentially include the very influential Saudi Arabia. The United States is the chief military backer of both Israel and Saudi Arabia. Has been pushing for these peace deals. The U.S. also recently, and very controversially, agreed to release $6 billion in return for American hostages held by Iran, whose Ayatollah celebrated the Hamas attack by posting a video of concert goers running for their lives. Catherine, this is the kind of event that could potentially redirect the course of several different countries and millions of people. What is one way of just sort of beginning to think about these events, or one thing people might keep in mind as they try to sort through the horrors of it all and imagine what comes next?
I find this question almost impossibly difficult to answer, both your specific question and the question of what to do and think about what happened in Israel this weekend. I think, you know, if I'm trying to kind of use the tools from my libertarian toolbox to answer this question, that one that comes to mind is, how do we think about this from the lens of property rights? That's inadequate. It's not going to get us everywhere we need to be. But, you know, if you don't think of that place as a single country, but instead think of it as lots of little plots of land that have been owned by different people and peoples over different times, you come to some different answers that seem less impossible. That's kind of my thinking on it. Like, we are not going to decide whether Israel or the Palestinians or Palestine own that giant chunk of territory by reasoning from first principles. But we might be able to decide who gets to live on this parcel of land at this time. By reasoning from property rights, it's still really hard because, of course, there's violence. Of course, there's incursions. Of course, there's self-defense. Of course, there's geopolitical forces that come into play on each individual parcel of land in that place. But that's the only way that I can see to get a toehold on it. It's terrible. It's really, really a mess. That's what I have for you. I wish I had more.
Is there not a case that it might be simpler in property rights than usual, just in the sense that it came from Gaza? Gazans have allegedly had rights to their property. They've been under a blockade as well, so that there's been pressure, but they've also been sending rockets into Israel by the thousands since electing Hamas in 2006, I believe. Israel left there in 2005 and said, you do it now. So then you have Gazans own their property, Israel owns their property, and they're at war.
Yeah. And of course, like, you know, private property ownership does not prevent war, as we have seen in Ukraine, as we have seen in you know, all of human history, but I think somewhat uniquely in the modern day in Israel-Palestine, there is this question of who was there first that looms larger. It's present in every territorial war, but it seems bigger and more complex there. And so the kind of property right to the individual pieces of land does feel more like the place you might go looking for answers when compared with, say, what's happening in Ukraine.
Nick, how's a way that you're trying to think through things as you're trying to think through things?
I think that the property rights issues have been pretty well settled, you know, and they were after World War II, and that, you know, this is a rare case where the attacks by Hamas, I think, are completely and utterly indefensible, not simply in terms of, you know, that they're abrogating an internationally recognized border, which they more or less have agreed to, or people in their names did generations ago, but the targeting of civilians and, you know, and fully innocent people. Like, if you are willing to go with, and I've seen this, the Democratic Socialists of America have been in this, there's a bunch of stupid student groups at Harvard who say, you know, this is a bad thing and it is completely Israel's fault. Like,
yes.
That is so fundamentally insane and awful in every permutation that it has. So that's the first starting point, is that this is a, you know, a completely unjustifiable attack on a sovereign nation, I think. You know, that for me, that's the beginning of it. What happens after that, Israel is a country which, you know, is fully capable of defending itself and defending its borders. And, you know, the question is, how much does their push on the, you know, in the other direction towards that, how much does that grow the conflict? How much does that destabilize the area? All of those are other questions. But I think that starting point is really, really important. I think it's also worth pointing out that Hamas, as you were saying, Matt, you know, took over de facto the Gaza governance, have done an incredibly awful job. They do not represent Palestinians in any, like, you know, clearly representative or powerful way. My hope is that coming out of this, that the violence is limited to what we've seen and what we might see over the next couple of days. And within the context of the broader Middle East, that you see a rearranging of kind of traditional alliances and whatnot to help tamp this down and to resolve things quickly rather than, you know, in the long haul. I went to, a couple of years ago, the Israeli consulate had an event in New York where they brought up a diplomat from D.C. who was talking about the U.S. leaving the area when we evacuated fully out of Iraq and everything, had forced the people who are actually in the area to, you know, start coming to terms with each other. And you see that in the Abraham Accords. You see that in the growing alliance between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and whatnot. And that scares Iraq, which is the other major regional power and which is clearly involved somehow to some degree in all of this. But I want to believe, and this is really just wish casting at this point, that, you know, in the wake of this horrible, you know, totally indefensible attack, that what comes out of it is, you know, an arrangement by the countries in that region that they are not going to put up with this type of, you know, longstanding provocation, and that a legitimate and, you know, lasting peace or arrangement between the Palestinians and Israel will come, you know, will come into play and be enforceable.
Peter, how are you trying to wrap your head around this, and what's a way to help other people as they sort through the rubble of it?
The word you used in your introduction was barbaric, and I think that is the right word here. This was a mass slaughter of innocents, of civilians who do not bear responsibility, in most cases, any kind of direct responsibility for government policy. And in some ways you can... Well, it's an imperfect analogy, but you can think of this as if an enemy of the United States sent raiders into neighborhoods, murdering people on the streets. Even if there were serious wrongs on the part of U.S. foreign policy, it's totally unjustified. It's totally horrific. There's no excusing this as some sort of reasonable or just response to terrible policy. I've been struggling over the past couple of days to understand and to kind of think about why Hamas would choose to do this. you know, they have stated their grievances, of course, and obviously that Israel is not without fault in the way that they have managed Palestine and handled that over the years. But Hamas had to understand the blowback that this would cause. Lots of Palestinians have already died, and many, many, many more are going to die in the war that follows. I think that's just a given at this point. And with a horrific attack like this, with an unprovoked slaughter, that was in some ways inevitable. Hamas leadership had to be aware of what sort of response this was going to provoke. And I think, you know, trying to pin this on any one reason or any one incident is probably a mistake, but there's almost certainly a complex array of reasons why this attack happened and why it happened now. But one is probably the three-way negotiations between the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia that you mentioned, Matt. And they appeared to be moving towards the Saudis potentially fully recognizing Israel, normalizing relations. This was part of the Abraham Accords that you talked about with the UAE and Bahrain. And, you know, without a peace deal between this might have happened without a peace deal between Israel and Palestine. And that deal would have been understood, certainly by Hamas, as a setback for Palestine and for Iran, which backs Hamas.
I think your nod towards the what would motivate the tactical use of that type of savagery is worth pausing on in general. Because you know, one knows that it's going to lead to a very, very large response from Israel, including the removal of Hamas. There's no way that a country on the receiving end of what happened Saturday morning is going to allow the neighboring country that produced it to have its regime stay intact. And that's, I mean, that is stone obvious. So then it makes you think again about the motivation. That's a weird thing for the leadership of a country to do, to engage in actions that guarantee that regime's removal from power, which says to me that this is much more likely something that was influenced by other countries, as have been the actions and behavior of Hamas for some time now. But it also is, it's worth always thinking about as kind of a cautionary tale, how the United States reacted to 9/11. It was an incredibly grievous blow, kind of sent everyone's minds kind of crazy for an extended period of time, and led to definite overreaction and calamity in terms of American foreign policy. So that's worth thinking about. The other thing that I'm thinking about,
I mean, on that tip, there's no way that this is going to lead to bad things. And we should just say this, right? Like there's nothing that can be done here that will make something good out of this. First of all, the event itself is horrific, but also there's going to be at least a very serious war. Possibly it won't last that long, but quite possibly it will. And quite possibly there is going to be a war here in the Middle East that spirals totally out of control and is not just a conflict between Israel and Palestine, is not just Israel trying to root out Hamas. There are very bad potential consequences here that could be with us for years and years.
The other thing that I'm thinking about has to do with exactly what you just said, Peter. I went to Israel about 1 year ago on a junket paid for by the U.S. Or the Israeli consulate in New York, and just toured around as an ignoramus because I don't know anything about that region and had never been there and have been trying really hard to avoid this conflict for a long time. It makes me uncomfortable.
You and everybody else in the region.
I don't like that. But going there gives you a sense of physical proximity of things. And the big thing, I was at the border of Gaza, actually probably at a place that's been overrun or was overrun, and talking to Israeli Defense Force person who was sitting there and explaining the Gaza border and all the skirmishes and the little wars that have happened in the Iron Dome, and said, yeah, none of this worries us even a fraction of the amount as we are worried about the fact that there are 100,000 rockets pointed at us from the north. That's the problem. That has been in a sort of a ceasefire stalemate deterrent standoff since 2006-ish, I want to say, from Lebanon. there are rockets at Lebanon, and you're just so incredibly close to very large cities because it's a really small country. So it's kind of a North Korea, South Korea situation in terms of the potential really bad things that could happen. So I am eyeing with the most kind of alarm, in addition to the what's going to be thousands of dead civilians. It's going to be really terrible what happens next. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, the other thing, speaking, you know, talking about the proximity and the size, the small size of this region, it's also that the Gaza, you know, Gaza has 2 million people. It's about the size of Washington, D.C. It's one of the most densely populated jurisdictions on the planet. So it makes it extremely hard to, you know, find the Hamas terrorists or you know, the people responsible for the terrorism and things like that. So that, you know, is one of the reasons why everybody is rightly assuming there is going to be a lot of collateral damage, a lot of innocent people killed in the reprisals, which, you know, is terrifying to think about. The other
Hamas also uses human shields. I mean, yeah. And they brag about this. This isn't this isn't, you know, hawkish scuttle, right? Like, this is a thing that Hamas says they do. And then they have said specifically in this case that many of the hostages that they took have been scattered around in military targets in an attempt to impede what they expect to be the Israeli incursion.
Having said that, that's also, you know, I think the world will give Israel, and it's not like a free pass or anything like that, but, you know, they will understand what the response entails, why it is necessary. And, you know, in the end, the blame, you know, assuming that Israel does not go completely blood red on everything, the world community will understand, you know, that there will be collateral damage that is ultimately caused by Hamas, not by Israel. It's interesting that the UAE actually condemned the attacks. Saudi Arabia is kind of ambivalent, which is actually in the context of this a sign that they are siding with Israel. The other main thing that I wanted to bring up was what does this mean vis-a-vis the United States? And this is a place where I think the libertarian principle of non-intervention is, you know, is strong and should be maintained. Israel is one country, you know, and certainly an ally to the U.S. that can defend itself and has shown its ability to do it without going into questions about ongoing aid to, you know, Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, other people in the area, other countries in the area. This is something that the U.S. can, you know, can show support, moral support and humanitarian aid and things like that. But we don't need to be involved militarily. And in fact, I think the minute we do that, that is one of the things that will tip things into a larger conflict that we would be smart to avoid.
Catherine, let's build up on that U.S. response angle. One thing that I've noticed, which is not surprising at all, is that people involved in American politics have tried to make Americans, or at least their political enemies, the protagonist of the story. Senator Tim Scott, who apparently is running for president in the Republican Party, tweeted out over the weekend that Biden's weakness invited the attack. Jen Rubin, the Washington Post's truthful, not neutral blogger, wrote that Republicans' weakness invites terror. I think that was a reference to congressional chaos on Capitol Hill, which we might be talking about very soon. What do you think, Catherine, both in terms of making the United States a main player character in this, but more concretely per Nick's initiation of this topic, what is a thing that the U.S. should be considering doing or not doing in terms of its policies that have to do with this region and in this conflict?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. has obviously horrifically bad main character syndrome. Like, it's just a ongoing issue with us. And this is not about us. We've been trying to make this conflict about us as long as I can remember, for sure, including like, oh, everybody just like come over for a sleepover at Camp David and we're going to solve this thing was the primary mode of us dealing with this for many, many, many years. But yeah, this is, I mean, to me, the thing we should be watching out for is because everyone was already at, God help me, I was about to say, everyone was already at battle stations, which is like, let's not use military metaphors for our legislative process at this point. Everybody had already manned the barricades. Everybody was already, loaded and ready to go because of the Ukraine fight, the fight over what the nature and scope of aid to Ukraine would be. You know, already kind of seeing some rumblings that whatever aid in whatever form goes to Israel, there will be attempts to try to package that together with Ukraine aid. And I think, you know, that's some sort of classic congressional shenanigans, but we should not do it in this case. Now and always, when issues are large and controversial and important, we should consider them independently, and Congress should debate them on their own merits. So I would love it if we could avoid the both stupidity of the debate that would result if we lump those two together, and also the genuine, I mean, just the problematic conflation of two very different circumstances. Nick is right. Israel has been, they've been ready for this. This is kind of Israel's whole thing. So they do not, you know, they do not need us the way Ukraine arguably needed us, leaving aside 1,000,000,000 questions about what that need entails in terms of our obligations. And, you know, this is more of a stay the course situation, I think. You know, we are their ally. We also give aid, though, as mentioned, to many other players in the region.
Peter, what do you want to see or not see from the U.S.?
What I want to not see from the U.S. is I want to not see us dragged into another massive open-ended proxy war. We're already in a massive open-ended proxy war, and it's not great. Now, I will say that the things have gone better in Ukraine than one might have expected on day one of that war, in some ways. However, better than expected is not is still not where you want to be. Where you want to be is not in a war, and I fear that very soon the United States could be, if not directly involved, then backing two very complex wars across the globe. And that's not someplace that the United States should be or should want to be.
For my part, I would like to see the Biden administration encourage as much as possible the forging of new peace deals. As much as I detest Saudi Arabia and the regime and everything associated with it and all the U.S. compromises involved with that, if there can be in this moment a, hey, you know what, don't go wobbly on trying to forge a peace deal, I think that's a fine role for the U.S. to play right now. And also to twist the screws a little bit on Qatar. We have declared, for whatever reason that escapes me, Qatar to be a major non-NATO ally of the United States. Qatar is where the Hamas leadership resides. They have been giving aid
direction. We also have major military bases there. That's
correct.
The reason.
That is the reason, which is one of, I think, the better arguments towards the problems of extending a Pax Americana in the world, is that you have to do deals with the devil in order to, well, that's a metaphorical thing, in order to have them stage your forward bases. If you did less forward basing, you could have actually a much more morality-based foreign policy. Anyways, I would like
more
them to put...
free basing, less forward basing.
All your that's base are belong to
nope.
us.
All right, let's move on to what was supposed to be our initial descent into madness, our lead topic of conversation before the world blew up, which is last week, Kevin McCarthy, the so-called Bakersfield Comet, was removed as Speaker of the House after an 8 Republican mutiny.
He burned too bright, Matt. He burned too bright.
I just, like, you can't have that amount of energy in the atmosphere. It just dissipates.
He might be like the Halley's Comet, though. Will he be back?
No, he's Comet Kohoutek, the great failed comet of the 70s that was prophesied to be a major media event and was a complete flop.
Failed comet, pretty good song, and a great check. Anyways, yeah, he was bounced after an 8 Republican mutiny of his colleagues led by Florida's hair model Matt Gaetz. We talked last week with perhaps surprising amounts of sympathy about Gates's reasons for wanting to remove McCarthy, having to do with regular order and spending and whatnot. So let's talk this week about the new contestants for leadership, which include the Trump-backed Jim Jordan of Ohio and Louisiana's own Steve Scalise, the number two Republican in the House. Catherine, do we have a rooting interest here in Planet Libertarian? Are there any reasons after the events of last week to hope for better governance in any way going forward?
Both of these topics make me turn to banana pudding. I don't know what to do here. Like, this is not good. These are not good choices. And this is 100% as predicted, right? Even the defenders of McCarthy, for the most part, the defense came along the lines of like, you got something better? You got, is there anyone in this entire room that you think should be in charge? And now we see who is available. And it's bad. Neither of these people are going to lead the U.S. Congress, lead the House to a brighter, more libertarian future. Neither of these people are going to bring rationality and order into this chaotic space. And on November 17th, we have to do this again because the continuing resolution is going to expire. And we're still not probably going to have a budget. You know, if we do, we're going to have one of those big, messy, dumb omnibus things. And that was exactly not what anyone asked for in the beginning or what they were promised, right? I mean, this is what we talked about last week. Like, in theory, there was this agreement that we were going to do something like regular order. And in practice, we did the farthest thing from that. It's awfully hard for me to imagine that between now and November 17th, we get all of those ducks in a row. And it's doubly hard for me to imagine Jim Jordan or Steve Scalise leading us to victory.
The great thing about continuing resolutions is you can always have another one.
It's like they don't continue, though. That's a problem. You got to continually make new ones.
Peter, sucks. You live in Washington by choice, from what I understand. What's the scuttlebutt out there in the gym, wherever you go, in the bar amongst the people who live in D.C. and wear a lot of khaki and navy blues and like the pearls and stuff? Is Matt Gaetz the most hated man in Washington, or are there secret pinky high fives going
you
on?
Lived here. Why do you act like D.C. Yeah. is like that when D.C. is not
totally
like that?
100%
as
like
if
that.
Matt Welch doesn't wear khakis and pearls.
As if he's not wearing khaki cargo shorts as we speak. Peter. Yeah.
So to answer that question, I've got to start with a disclosure, which is that I've been living in my own version of Washington, D.C. for a long time, even before I'd ever been here, because I went to high school with Matt Gaetz. And we were on the forensics and debate team together. And while I wouldn't say that we were close friends or anything like that, we did spend a fair amount of time on the school bus going to debate tournaments where he and I would both compete. So full disclosure, I went to high school with Matt Gaetz.
Tell us about the underage girls, Peter. Come on, let's skip to the
important
stuff.
He and I were both underage at the time, is all I will say about that. I don't know that there's any scuttle in the gym. Maybe there's scuttlebutt about the Jim Jordan.
Yeah.
No.
Yes. This seems like Jim Jordan's race to lose to me. And I think he will end up with it, not because he is the better choice, not because he refuses to wear a jacket and that has become a fun signature for him, not for any real policy reason at all, but simply because he is probably going to be more amenable to the hardliners who can control the outcome of this vote, simply because the Republican majority in the House is so small that a very tiny number of people can basically decide, I'm only going to vote for one of these guys, and therefore everybody else is going to have to follow us, right? And so it's like five votes. If five people can basically form a gang to say, we want Jordan and not Scalise, then Jordan gets it almost by default, because there's no other choice for the rest of the Republicans except to not have a speaker at all.
Nick, what do you see besides despair?
Nothing, really. It's all darkness there. I do want to point out that Catherine wearing headphones, people can't see this because we haven't put the video together yet, but you are totally rocking a Princess Leia pre-Halloween costume right now.
That is true. I've got my, my white mock turtleneck and my my cinnamon
buns.
Rolls.
Yeah. So, and I, and Matt, I bring that up mostly to divert from this question. the fact that Kevin McCarthy, and even before him, Paul Ryan, and in many ways, even before him, John Boehner, were Republican speakers, it shows the Republican Party, you know, and I mean, Reason for the past 20 years has been documenting this. The Republican Party, even before Donald Trump, lost its way. It lost its core set of beliefs that it was trying to actually meet policy-wise with its rhetoric towards limited government, smaller government, less spending, you know, getting rid of socialized healthcare, all of this kind of stuff. They have elected a, you know, a race of pygmy men to the speaker position, and that is in no way to you know, put down pygmies who are a proud people and actually can govern themselves. But we have seen just a collection of real bums have to be forced into the speaker position. I mean, Paul Ryan did not want to be Speaker of the House because he knew it's a shit job, especially with the people involved now. Kevin McCarthy, what did it take, like 17 rounds or what? How many votes did it take to get him there? Neither Jim Jordan nor Steve Scalise are going to solve any of the endemic problems. So even if one of them manages to be, get elected speaker, we're going to have the same kind of gridlock just within the Republican caucus of them not being able to actually focus on what they claim their party is all about. So to me, that's like the larger issue. And I actually think coming out of this, one of them may become a speaker. I would not be surprised at all to see somebody new emerge as a kind of consensus placeholder until they lose the House in the next election, regardless of what happens at the presidential level. I mean, the Republican Party has shown an amazing inability to win easy elections because they do not follow, you know, their rhetoric of wanting to be the party of smaller government. They're just terrible on that. And this is where it ends for them.
It's just hard to see that this ends up helping with the goals that the rebels who voted out McCarthy, Gates in particular, say that they want. And as sympathetic as I am to their stated goals, you know, I think not passing single spending subject bills is chaos, said Gates, right? The fact that we've been governed in this country since the mid-90s by continuing resolution and omnibus is chaos. He's responding to the charge that he's just causing chaos by saying, look, it's already chaos and it's already bad. And there is a way in which he is right. But what he has done is cause more chaos and make it less likely that we are going to return to regular order and less likely that we are going to have an orderly budget process with a dozen appropriations bills where we cut spending and reduce the deficit and deal with all of the fiscal problems that we have.
Yeah, this is total wish casting, but it's like, hopefully Gates, you know, and who has worked with people like AOC, you know, on the kind of other side of the horseshoe and everything. Like, I would love to see Congress say, okay, you know what, we really have fucked up and we are going to, independent of the outcome, we are going to commit to budget order. And you know what? We're going to work from now until whenever those budget bills are done, you know, and actually do a heavy lift for once. Because these, I mean, it is amazing that these people are on the public payroll. They do nothing. You know, their whole job is to fucking pass a budget. And that is the last thing that any of them ever gets around to doing. So
they fundraise.
I will not be pioneering this comparison, which is the only reason that I'm willing to consider making it right now. A couple of months ago, in my editor's note for the print magazine, I chronicled a bunch of folks on the Hill calling the desire to debate and talk about debt and deficit and our budget dysfunction terrorism. people on the Hill were just calling each other terrorists for holding positions about this issue and you know, doing hardball politics about it. I can't help but notice, you know, it's like there's a tactical problem here. Like, everyone is just causing chaos in the vague hopes that the chaos is a ladder. And it's, you know, it is a terroristic style. Like, obviously that comparison is bananas, and more so now that we are witnessing what real terrorism looks like in the Middle East. Being reminded what it really looks like. But still, the let's just mess everything up and then, like, you know, dot, 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 regular order, It's not going to happen.
My rooting interest, for what it's worth, is against Jim Jordan for three reasons, I think.
Is one of them the shirt?
No, actually, I'm fine with the shirt. I don't like that he has a close relationship with and is being backed by the once and future president, Donald J. Trump. I wish there to be a more antagonistic relationship between the congressional and the legislative and the executive branch in general. And that's been one of the bad erosions in politics. I don't like the way Jim Jordan has changed his policy and approach very nakedly and opportunistically in the Trump era, and his convictions and values based on, you know, his work in the Freedom Caucus before Trump was elected and afterwards. He just seems very transparently politically opportunistic and beliefless. And I think we need less of that in politics. And we also need less of, my third reason for him, he just seems like a jerk. I think we need fewer jerks in American politics. Scalise seems like a
bold
nicer
statement,
guy.
Matt Welch.
Thank you. Thank
taking
you.
Taking the anti-jerk stance. That is going to get you disinvited from all those cocktail parties in Brooklyn.
I know. It's a great sadness to never leave my basement. All right. We're going to get to our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, a reminder that this episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Friends, you ever watch sports ball on TV and hear an announcer talk about how such and such a player is running downhill? Even though, if you notice, the field of play is in fact flat. It's a metaphor. It's to describe physical activity of the highest function. Look, Johnny or Janie athlete is moving so fast, so apparently unencumbered by obstruction, it appears that they're actually running downhill. So let's extend that metaphor to your day-to-day life of the mind, mentally and emotionally. Are you running freely with gravity on your side as you go through your day? Or are there internal obstructions holding you back? That's where BetterHelp Online Therapy comes in. BetterHelp is an easy-to-use, super flexible, entirely online therapy service that has helped many listeners of this podcast move more freely about the playing field of their lives. All you have to do is fill out a quick questionnaire, get matched with a therapist. If you don't like the first one, just swap them out for a second. Let therapy free up your mental function with BetterHelp. Just visit betterhelp.com/roundtable right now to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/roundtable. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to please email your short queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Justin Rodstrom, who writes, "Hi all, longtime listener, love your non-binary takes. Thank you, even if I don't always agree with them. Thank you twice. My question is this. Whether we're talking about immigration policy or decriminalizing certain drugs or reducing the role of policing, it seems that libertarians often support policies that many citizens view as materially eroding their quality of life. It's almost like the libertarian mantra is individual preferences are absolutely paramount unless those preferences include living in a country, state, city you find to be tolerable." Now for the actual question. Is there a principled libertarian way to respect public policies that create rules and boundaries in common spaces? Or is quality of life just the price we pay for individual freedom? Catherine, what say you?
I say that this question is pretty far from the way that I think about things. And so I actually struggled with it a little bit. But I guess my first answer is, like, in the sort of big picture, I think it's pretty clear that the type of policies that libertarians advocate for have materially improved the quality of life for almost everyone that they have touched. And I recognize that the scope of this question is narrower. It's kind of like stuff we've been debating in the last five-ish years. And that can be a different question, but I kind of want to lay down the groundwork first, which is that by enabling people to live out their individual preferences in the marketplace and also in their private lives, actually the public life of the world, like everyone's public square has gotten more peaceful, more interesting, more plentiful. Like there's just a lot less starving to death. And so I think that's like you should really give some credit to this cluster of references for that. After that, I think you know, there are, in fact, many, many ways to find a country, state, city that you find tolerable. It might require you to move. Like, this is the exit versus voice kind of debate. And so, you know, I think there are, like, there are lots of people who right now, for instance, feel like the cores of cities are unpleasant and that maybe that's related to certain libertarian policies. I would debate that principle. But even if you grant it, there are tons and tons and tons of places in this country that you could go to form a community, to join a community that looks more like your slate of preferences. And I don't think that anyone has the right to say, I am here and I want the people around me to behave in a certain way for my comfort. Like, that is a limit on libertarianism. We can debate it. We can talk about it. I personally think we should also reduce the number of common spaces, right? Privately owned spaces can be governed by whatever rules those owners want. But I don't, I find the premise of the question to be one that I recognize other people hold, and also one that doesn't fully make sense to me on my understanding of the broader impact of libertarian policies in the world.
Suderman, you live in a place that people point to as being like part of the problem. Well, the people getting like carjacked in their dorm rooms. How do you answer this question?
Carjacked outside of the congressional dorm, because congressmen live in a dorm. Not all of them, but a lot of them. It's true.
I was so messy and disordered when I lived in a dorm. I do feel like that possibly explains a lot about Congress. Like, don't live in a dorm.
Some of them sleep on cots in their offices.
Also, don't do that. Like, that's going to make you be testy and weird.
Let's not talk about congressional salaries and housing costs in D.C. at the moment. So I agree with Catherine. The big picture, easy libertarian answer is there should be fewer public spaces. But that's not really what this question is about. Colloquially and perhaps coarsely, this is a bums in the park question. What do we do about the bums in the park? They're setting up tents. They're living there.
I thought you said we weren't going to talk about Congress.
Yeah, right? This is and sometimes they're doing drugs and they're having their crazy manic episodes. And you know what? This happens in parks near me that I walk through sometimes. And in some ways, the big picture, non-responsive answer is actually the answer here. Because in my neighborhood, or very close to where I live, there is a private park. A little private park nestled behind a bunch of row houses. You kind of can't see it from the street. You have to know that it's there. It is entirely run by the community. It is one of the only parks within walking distance of my house that did not shut down during COVID, because the DC Public Parks Department and the federal parks and whoever it is that runs the parks that are paid for with tax dollars around here, they shut all of that down during COVID. And so I was able to walk my dog up to this little nice private park. You know what this little nice private park doesn't have as a problem? It doesn't have bums, doesn't have people doing drugs in it, because it's cared for and entirely paid for. Also, this is important, entirely paid for by the neighbors and the neighborhood. And so that can help solve a bunch of those problems. Beyond that, I think that libertarians need to have better and clearer answers about what to do with significant disorder and people who are having very serious mental and emotional health issues in public spaces, and who are deciding to make those spaces either difficult, unpleasant, or unusable in some cases for the public at large. We're not going to not have public parks, period, even if that's Catherine's preferred world. But since we are not going to have them, we need to figure out rules that make them functional and usable for the largest number of people.
Nick, how do you answer that question?
I want to be a New York exceptionalist and just talk to you. The other guys can close their ears for a second. But they must live in a non-real city, right?
Ooh.
Because I think you and I both live in a place where it's like, first off, I don't want New York to be turned into a bunch of private places where you can't walk down the street because you need permission from the people who own the street. So you're going to have to go walk around or like pay everybody on the corner. I mean, that seems to me to be like a bad idea. It's also totally unrealistic to expect every park to be dealt with like Gramercy Park, where it's locked and gated. originally to keep people like my Irish and Italian ancestors out, because that way you could have a nice space. You know, I don't think it's complicated to say there should be things like, you know, the Office of Reason, the beautiful new offices are on a, you know, they have a public sidewalk in front of them. You shouldn't be allowed to shit on that sidewalk. You should be ticketed, right? Like, that's not complicated. And I don't think it contravenes the non-aggression principle or anything like that, just to say there are certain levels of decorum which are going to be upheld. It gets cloudy really quickly because in the past, for instance, if you were a man and you dressed as a woman, if you were a transvestite, you could be arrested for dressing in the wrong gender's clothes. All of that is bad. The principle of basic levels of public decorum. I lived in Los Angeles when I started working at Reason in the early 90s, and almost 30 years ago. My son was born a month after we moved there. We lived on Stoner Avenue of all streets. It wasn't a choice. It just was the best rent. And every morning at 6 o'clock, a fucking asshole would come by and honk the horn to tell the person he was giving a ride to across the street, like, "Hey, I'm here." The yard was like 20 feet long. It was, you know, and I went over to the person who lived there and I said, "Hey, you know, would you mind not honking your horn every morning at 6 a.m. because I have a newborn who wakes up with that and is screaming and it's really disruptive. I'm sorry, it's bothering other people." And their answer to that nice request was, "Fuck you, get the fuck out of here." And so I called the police and I said, "Hey, can you do anything about this? Because there are noise ordinances where you're not supposed to start lawnmowers, et cetera, before a certain time." And the police, of course, and this goes to the libertarian uselessness of police, were like, "Well, our shifts are changing then, so we really can't do anything for you." That's a bad world, right? The police suck, but the ordinance
is not a bad
idea.
That's just the world, though. That's the actual world when we try to solve this problem using public resources.
No, but we tried using private resources. Should I stood outside and like shot the guy with a BB gun every time he did it or something? I'm just saying there's nothing wrong with general order ordinances as long as we are on top of them to make them as minimal as possible, to make sure that they're not being used as a campaign to keep blacks out of areas or to keep, you know, gender nonconforming activities from happening, all kinds of disparate impacts. But I think it's wrong to think that libertarians can't believe in common spaces that have rules that are set not by, you know, private actors who will shoot you on sight if you happen to walk across their yard.
I would say that if you're going to do this, you have to pair that, though, with rules that create spaces for people who want
to
do stuff.
Buildings,
well, who want to do stuff that may not be that may not be acceptable or what we think of as, you know, sort of the norm in public. For example, if you want to tell people you can't do drugs in the park, you have to if you're for drug legalization, then you need spaces where you can do drugs. And in many cases, that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Okay, and that's fully consistent with everything that I've said. I'm just saying, like, you know, I live on Bleecker Street in New York, which is a busy street. I live above a restaurant and a couple of bars. If I were every night at midnight or whenever the noise ordinance says everything has to be shut down, if I was calling the police every night to be like, "Can you believe it that there are people out here making a noise?" That is a strong argument to say I'm an idiot for moving into a place where this is going to happen. However, if it's 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock in the morning and somebody is making noise or driving around in cars that are not, that are designed to make an enormous amount of noise and doing laps around the block, I think that I'm within my rights to say, you know what, there is an ordinance in place. And that's a legitimate, thing to get exercised about and to call the cops about.
I think you can think of public parks as government programs, and one thing that I have that I think about government programs is that
I'm not talking about the street, which is slightly different.
Fine, public spaces you can think of as government programs, and one thing that I think libertarians should think about government programs is, on the one hand, we want fewer of them, and on the other hand, we want them to be run well and efficiently, and we want them to not be run in ways that are stupid.
And thirdly, we want to be able to opt out of government programs that don't work for us. And again, my argument was not make New York have no public parks and be a totally different place. My argument was, hey, if you don't like the way things are going in New York, move to a place in Oklahoma with an HOA. And those are just two of the thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of options. And I think that that is the libertarian response to this concern in large part, not only, but in large part, and that it is currently being undervalued by people who live in the few extremely dense areas where there is an uptick in this type of dysfunction. And I wish that libertarians would hold firm in our principles, even when it is annoying that someone is doing fentanyl on your front yard.
It's not just annoying, it's illegal. Rightly so.
A lot of things are, okay, rightly, fine. Use your rightly so.
It's not libertarians' fault that people are stealing from Target and CVS. There's just not. So stop thinking that it is for those who are tempted to do such. All right. Speaking of temptations, I'm tempted to go straight to the what we have all been consuming since it's at that point of the podcast. So why don't we start off with Nicholas Gillespie?
So I was in Las Vegas on Friday to go to the Sphere Experience, which is something that Madison Square Garden has put out. And it is a massive new structure. It's the largest, and I don't know exactly what this means, but it sounds kind of visionary and exciting. It's the largest sphere on Earth other than Earth itself.
That's a good tagline.
Among other things, it is a theater that everybody was telling me different numbers, but I think it's like about 13,000 people. A couple of weeks ago, U2 started a residency there. You go into this place and there are a bunch of robots that I should mention that my fiance helped to design the personalities of, which is a whole new industry that AI is helping to create. You go in and it's about kind of technology in the future. There's a 13,000 seat theater, which has a kind of wraparound screen. It's not quite 360 degrees, but it's pretty close. That is amazing. U2 performed there. I highly recommend people look at the Instagram, footage from inside that performance, where it's a mix of multimedia and the band playing, by all accounts, great. I was there to see the debut or the premiere of Darren Aronofsky's movie Postcard from Earth, which is phenomenal as a demonstration of the technology. It is immersive in a way that IMAX attempts to be, that 3D has attempted to be. The seats are haptic, so you feel certain motions. There are kind of wind effects in the theater, and the immensity of the footage, it's something like 18K. So you don't see pixelation. You don't see, all you see is image of giant mountains of, elephants and rhinoceroses and all kinds of things like that. It's kind of potentially, we'll see, because it's a new kind of canvas, but potentially a next leap forward in kind of immersive real life entertainment. And ironically, I've been following this in a lot of artists that I've talked to, for Reason and elsewhere, about the need people, because our lives are completely defined by screens now. You want art to be immersive, whether it's a performance, or a reading or whatever. In a weird way, this gets past that by having the ultimate screen that kind of wraps around you and entrances you and immerses you into a different type of experience. So that's where I was, the Sphere. If you're in Vegas, I highly, highly recommend it. It's become something of an icon already, because on the outside, they run different kind of visualizations of everything from looking like the Earth to a giant eyeball to a giant emoji, et cetera. It's really stunning. And it's, one of those moments which are all too rare, where you feel like, okay, this is the beginning of a different future or a different present, like you're in the future. Highly recommend it.
I want to know who designed Catherine's robot personality.
Yeah.
She's sui generis.
That's also true. I was just going to say that this is the future libertarians actually want. Giant spherical eyeballs and whatnot. Peter, what did you consume?
I watched the movie Reptile on Netflix. It's okay. Kind of moody, kind of gloomy, a little bit David Fincher-ish, but not nearly as good. It's got Benicio del Toro and Justin Timberlake and Alicia Silverstone, who I haven't seen on screen in a long time and who is really quite good in this. Like I said, the movie is only okay, but, and I am not the person to coin this phrase, kind of plays like a game of civil libertarian bingo, because it's all about the ways that cops manipulate the system to give themselves advantages, including doing things like planting drugs on houses so that they can be asset forfeitured and then sold off to shady real estate developers. And of course, there's some murder involved. Anyway, it's not a great movie, but it's not a terrible one. If you want a dark, moody thriller that has a bunch of libertarian elements, it's all right. And it's on Netflix.
Very good. Catherine, what did you consume?
I consumed some of the work of Claudia Golden, the economist who just won a Nobel Prize. Reason has been covering some of her work off and on for a long time, but I will confess that I did not have a bead on her until her prize was announced. She has done a bunch of work on women in the women in labor markets. And the thing that is fascinating to me is I read the New York Times write-up of her work, and you would not know from reading that write-up that one of her signature findings is like, hey, maybe the wage gap in the present is explained in some significant part by differential preferences and choices on the part of individual women and how they react to market opportunities rather than broad-based discrimination. You can't tell that from the New York Times write-up. Luckily for me, I got, I poked around the Reason's archive and also got a nice email from a pal of Reason pointing me to, among other things, a paper she wrote about how come there are so many lady pharmacists and how come they're paid so good? And the answer is like everything that you would not look at if you were coming at this question from a different point of view. So the answer is actually like the death of mom and pop pharmacies reduced the penalty for part-time work and increased technological change, made it so that multiple pharmacists could work multiple shifts in an interchangeable way. And the way that the field was credentialed shifted, and so it made it easier to acquire that education. And that also women maximize earnings per hour worked, and they maximize earnings in the context of high flexibility. And pharmacists is a thing where you can do that. So it's actually like a very cool story of technological change, consolidation, creative destruction, and individual choice. And the fact that this lady managed to thread the needle of writing stuff like this paper and then get a Nobel Prize is fantastic. So congratulations to Claudia Golden. Well-deserved Nobel Prize.
So I watched on the plane, so there might have been a little bit of weepery. Nick, you'll be happy to know that I cried at the Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band's concert from the No Nukes show in 1979, but that's not why I'm sharing. I watched Being Mary Tyler Moore, a documentary that came out in May of this year, directed by James Adolphus, and suffers from the usual executive producer itis. It obviously was initiated by her longtime husband, third in that category. And so there's the kind of approval over everything. And then the third act, it's really all about the husband kind of situation. But it's very moving and interesting, particularly if people exactly of mine, maybe Nick's generation, whose parents, my parents, especially my mom, especially, just grew up looking to Mary Tyler Moore as this incredible breakthrough popular culture figure, especially the character that she played in the Mary Tyler Moore Show, who was a 30-year-old single woman, single professional woman out there. She was going to make it after all and turn the world around, Matt Welch. Working in a professional setting and striving and having a life with a lot of strong women friends. It's fascinating to watch that get relived, the run-up to it, which was her role in the Dick Van Dyke Show as Dick Van Dyke's wife, and the little subtle ways in that program, which I believe began around 1964-ish, ran for about 5 years, where she was not a huge name at all when she was selected by Carl Reiner there, but she's like, well, why? I don't want to be a housewife like running the vacuum cleaner in the little like a skirt kind of situation. Don't make me a 50s housewife. I'm gonna be wearing pants like my friends do. And just these little kind of details of her life that kind of led to these sort of feminist breakthroughs. And then by the time that they're in a position to make a show of her own, which she did with her second husband, Grant Tinker, who hadn't been an advertising executive, and then through this partnership started to become a huge television executive, including at MTM Enterprises. When they were sitting around and figuring out how to do the show, they're like, okay, we're going to have a divorcee. And they immediately said, nope. I think the quote was something along the lines of, three rules in television at CBS, we're never going to have a Jew, never going to have a divorcee, and I forget what the third rule is, but there's definitely a rule of three. And so they just made her single instead. But all of these little kind of details add up to this incredible breakthrough that which we all watched and felt who are old enough to have been there. And it's really interesting to see her own relationship with that kind of breakthrough. It was probably too much for her to bear, of how much everyone, like all the women admired her, all the men kind of wanted to date her, and everyone was kind of cool with it. And the relationship with modern feminism with her is fascinating too. There's a great little clip of Gloria Steinem taking to task the main showrunner, James L. Brooks, at a conference in D.C. because she's like, why does Mary have to call him Mr. Grant? That's not very feminist. And it's just amazing and interesting to see how people, and this resonates in our modern time too, can like bust the chops of what is inarguably kind of the biggest feminist breakthrough in television history. Even bigger than I Love Lucy being all about, Lucy, and being about her production company. So it's really interesting. And of course, Mary Tyler Moore was married throughout this whole time portraying a single professional woman, and her life was an absolute, you know, mess in many parts, and that they kind of soft pedal that. But it's fascinating. It's very moving. And just on a pure, like, you know, all these tales of people, of artists who at some point just like completely reach the pinnacle. That is always fascinating. The watching them at their pinnacle and watching people's reactions and watching them look back at it, it will never not be fascinating. And the level of chance and magic that goes into it is
Matt,
interesting.
Yes. Particularly given your bromance with the Roman Catholic Church, I highly recommend you watch Change of Habit, the 1969 Elvis movie she made.
That's right.
Where she plays a nun. You might find that fascinating.
She only played that part.
Religious journey.
Nick, because she had to give up the right of first refusal on a movie deal because she had bombed so badly on Broadway playing Breakfast at Tiffany's. Fun fact. All right, that's enough of me talking, period. Thank you for listening to the Reason Roundtable podcast. We do this every week. Please listen to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcast. We also have 5,000 events coming up. So why don't either Catherine or Peter, unusually, talk about whoever's the best, talk about an event that's happening in Reason's office in Washington, D.C.
In exactly 1 week, next Monday, I am going to be hosting a conversation between Virginia Postrel, former editor of Reason Magazine, and Jim Pethikoukas from the American Enterprise Institute, who has a new book out about the future and how we should embrace it.
Nick, you have 15 seconds to name one of the 75 events that you're doing in October in New York.
We've got two events this week. Go to reason.com/events. to check them out. One is on Tuesday, one is on Wednesday. One involves psychedelics, the other involves civility.
Beautiful. Psychedelic civility is where it's all at. If you like what we do as an organization, please consider donating to us, reason.com/donate. And other than that, we will see you next week. Thank you. Goodbye.